This is the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show number 61. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show Christmas Edition. You can find us at pitchvision.com and email us on mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe.
And my name's Jared Kimber.
And because it's Christmas, this week we're turning the show over to a special interview with our guest co-presenter, Jared. He's a writer and cricket blogger at cricketwithballs.com, as you probably already know. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Your family are cricket fundamentalists. Does that make you one as well?
Yeah, I suppose I didn't have much hope. In our family, you basically got to talk about three topics. It was Aussie rules, football, politics and cricket. And if you didn't take an extreme view on one of them, you were left out. So there was a lot of yelling and loud talking and little cliques formed. And it was an interesting time. And Christmas Day especially was probably when it got most vocal, because the next day obviously was Boxing Day. So we all fired up, ready for our home test.
Yeah, so the fights weren't over presents or people getting annoyed with each other. They were over who's going to win the Test match.
Yeah, who should be dropped? What Steve Waugh's doing wrong? What Ricky Ponting's doing wrong? What Alan Border's doing wrong? Whoever the captain was, someone had an opinion. You know what the other team's doing. If someone talked up someone from the other team, there'd be three other people telling him that that person wasn't any good. Just good banter, but our family tends to be fairly loud and opinionated. So if you were to walk into the situation, as a few girlfriends and boyfriends did over the years, they were a little bit shocked at people full-on abusing each other over cricket on Christmas Day.
And so I suppose that's how and why your site, Cricket With Balls, doesn't hold too many punches either.
Yeah, well, Cricket With Balls, one of the people that I actually originally started it with was my cousin. And so it was my cousin and another friend of ours. And, yeah, we pretty much continued the family tradition on even when we weren't all meeting up as a family. And I suppose the way that we looked at it when we first started the site was that we wanted it to be how real people spoke about cricket rather than about the sort of saccharine version that you have in mainstream media. So, I mean, it wasn't my opinion that I was going to come in and be completely different. I just wanted to do what I thought other people were doing in pubs and in their lounge rooms around the world.
So you were being different by being the same?
Yeah. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I don't do that much different to what other people do. I suppose the difference is I'm willing to put my name to outlandish claims and I'm willing to, put them up on the website and talk a little bit of filth on the website. And whereas other people, I suppose once you get to a certain level, you usually start to pare back your opinions and be a little bit safer. For whatever reason, I don't really have that gear.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because it's written under the name of J-Rod, which is a slight pseudonym, although it's not particularly difficult to find out who you are. But how much is J-Rod a persona compared to the real you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was asked this by a friend not that long ago. In a lot of ways, J-Rod sort of became a writing persona without me really meaning him to be. A lot of people think that Cricket With Balls is my normal writing style, but when I write in other formats, I don't always write in that same way. So yeah. I suppose in a way it is a persona, but it's the persona I used with my mates when I was at the pub. So, I mean, it is a part of me one way or the other. It definitely isn't something fake. It came naturally. But, I mean, when I write under Jared Kimber, which I do on Crick Info, I wrote under Jared Kimber on Crikey. I don't think it's that much different when I write for them. Obviously, if I write for Crick Info, I have to take out all the swear words and I'm not allowed to mention sex. and on Crikey, I have to be a little bit careful that I'm not defaming anyone. But I think it's still fairly similar. I think whatever it is, that J-Rod persona is probably just how I like to write about cricket.
So it's more like J-Rod is a bit more like you and the other writing is a bit more toned down version of him.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I think all my writing's fairly fairly full on. But I mean, one thing that J-Rod is the short, sharp sentences. Which is something that I never did before. In fact, I was always I would always write sentences that went for a paragraph and a half. And then for whatever reason, once I started writing Cricket with Balls, there would be these really short sentences, and I don't even use paragraphs on Cricket with Balls. So it's a completely different way of doing it. And I'd have to say it came naturally. To be honest, when I started the blog, I wasn't really thinking about how I was writing. It just sort of came out.
Okay. And do you find now you have to think a little bit about it, or is it just so natural now that, you know, it's just how you write it and it just developed itself?
Yeah, I suppose the only thing that I worry about now is that I don't like to become a caricature of myself, which is what happens, I suppose, especially, you know, I've been around for a couple of years now, and so most people know me, and people know me for different things, but you sort of, like, I get asked a lot to repeat certain posts, but about different players. Yeah. And so I suppose in a lot of ways, for the last probably 6 to 12 months especially, I've been working on trying to come up with original ideas each time rather than just falling back into my safe zone, which is what's, you know, people have already liked. I'd rather write 5 posts that 2 are amazingly funny and 2 don't make sense at all and 1's just okay, rather than just writing 5 that everyone loves, but they only love them because they've read them before.
Well, they say that it's better to be to have some people who hate you and some people who love you than have everybody who just says, oh, well, that's all right.
Oh, I love it. I love getting hate emails and hate comments because if I was in the middle ground, I wouldn't really be comfortable with my writing. I like getting extreme reactions. I think I was called pure unadulterated trash the other day by a South African, and I've just been done for Indian bashing by another Indian who doesn't like me. And I, you know, get the odd email like that all the time. To be honest, I do get a lot more emails that are positive, but if I didn't get any negative emails or any negative comments on the site, I'd be a little bit worried about what I was doing.
Let's change tack slightly, because this is essentially a show about playing and coaching cricket.
Mm-hmm.
And you play.
That's right.
What kind of standard do you play?
I play in the, what is it? It's a Middlesex League in London. Right. So I think it's a fairly high standard, although I play thirds at last year. Last year I did my knee, so I played on one leg for the second half of the season. But it's a fairly high standard of cricket as a competition. I was surprised, actually, but I think at the top levels, a lot of the Middlesex contracted players come down and play the odd game. So it's obviously a fairly high standard of cricket.
And how was your season last year?
I went all right. I mean, it's hard to play on one leg. It was harder than I thought. I completely lost my bowling action a couple of times, and I think in the end I used about 7 different bowling actions just because I could never find one that would replicate my old one. But because of my knee, I had a very bouncy, Mushtaq Ahmed type leg spinning action. Mm. You can't bounce when your knee's in trouble. So I think during the year I would find a technique based on that particular day that I could do. I think I ended up with a bowling average of about 20, but there was a couple of 20 run overs in there as well. But I made a few runs, I must admit. I do enjoy the smaller English grounds, especially when you do have the sore knee. A couple of hits over the top, suddenly everyone's on the boundary and I can just stroll through for a single.
What about coaching? Have you ever done any coaching?
Yeah, I did some coaching a few years back. When I was about, I must have been about 18 or 19, my cousin's under 16 side, they didn't really have a coach. They had some parents who were doing it, but they didn't really have a cricket background. So they brought me in, and I really loved it. Unfortunately, I could only do it for about 2/3 of the season. But I really enjoyed working, especially working with people one-on-one. They had a wicketkeeper who I suppose he had a technique more like a hockey goalie than a wicketkeeper. Mm. And by the end of the year, I had him standing and wicketkeeping, and finally the rest of his teammates weren't abusing him every game. And I also got their running between wickets was something that they just really didn't do as a team. They basically hit 4s or stood there. And by the end of the year, they were really running quite well together, and they made the finals. To be honest, if you would have seen them at the start of the year, you would have thought they would have finished last. So to even finish in the top 4 was a big effort. I really enjoyed that. And other than that, I've just done the other little bit of individual coaching. And then last year, my now wife, but she was my girlfriend at the time, her and some of her friends wanted some coaching. So I took a bunch of women down to the park who'd never really played cricket before and taught them about, you know, just the fundamentals of the game, and tried to get their feet going in the right direction and get, you know, get their left arm up when they were bowling and things like that.
Have you seen much coaching at the club you play at now in the UK?
No. I must admit that they don't seem to really believe in training or coaching too much.
I think that's quite common.
Yeah. It's a bit of a shock for me, especially my fielding really dropped off this year. And I realised my fielding dropped off because in Australia I would do an hour of fielding, well, probably 2 hours of fielding a week, plus half an hour of warm-ups of different kind of fielding, whereas over here, you know, the average club really just strolls out and plays. Yeah, my fielding is sort of completely dropped off. And I actually started taking a golf ball with me just to practice a little bit on my own if I could get any sort of brick background. But they do have a Colts section at my club, so hopefully next year I might be involved in the Colts a little bit.
Yeah, they do tend to. It's the same at the clubs that I've played at over the years. They do tend to give you a funny look if you run around the outfield to warm up or something. You get people wondering what's going on.
Yeah, it's just so different to Australia, because in Australia you get a funny look if you just turn up and play. In a lot of the levels that I played at, we used to have an hour warm up before a game, fielding, stretching, batting, bowling, throwing, like almost every facet. Only a few minutes on each, but you know, we did everything. And you know, if a team turned up to play us and didn't do any of that sort of stuff, we pretty much thought that we had them before they started.
And talking about coaching, talking about coaching at a slightly different level, one of the things that I've noticed with coaching is there seems to be a direct relationship between how much respect a coach gets and the level that they've played. So like, it's almost like ex-professionals have the keys to the magical kingdom of professional cricket or something like that, especially when they're working with younger players. Do you think that that relationship is valid?
No. I've seen a lot of champion players who are really rubbish coaches. So, I mean, if that was the case, Greg Chappell would be one of the best coaches in the world. And I think, you know, even the average punter would disagree with that. He was horrible with South Australia and horrible with India. For some reason, he keeps getting jobs. No, I mean, it's not something that I've ever particularly thought about. I know at club level in Australia, it doesn't seem to be as important as I've noticed it is over here. Every time I run into a coach over here, especially in London, they seem to be, you know, they have to have their story about who they played against and whatever. Whereas in club level in Australia, I always noticed it had more to do with what they could bring out of their team. My father he coached us all the way through juniors, and me and my mates, we won two grand finals with him, and he was an excellent batting coach, and yet he was a number 11 his whole life. And I think he might have made 150 in his whole life. Couldn't bat to save himself, had no real idea about it. But as a coach, he would get the best out of us as a batting team. And in the end, we were probably as much a batting team as we were a bowling team. So for me, it really has no correlation. I think sometimes great players have trouble getting good performances out of average players because they don't understand the dynamic that the average player has.
It's definitely a different skill set. I agree with you on that. A different, a different thing, and one doesn't always equate to the other. I did get in trouble a few shows ago when I said that I think if someone has an ambition of being a professional cricketer, which we get a lot of people getting in touch with us about that particular ambition, I got in a bit of trouble by saying that you probably want to go with someone who has been there and they know at least what it takes to get there. And also that they need to be a good coach. But the two, you don't necessarily have to just be a first-class player to be a good coach. You need to be a good coach, and also you probably need that experience of getting there if you want to get there yourself. But that got me in a bit of trouble.
Okay. Well, Neil DaCosta, who is Michael Clarke and Philip Hughes' batting coach, I haven't checked up, but I'm pretty sure he never played first-class cricket. And yet, if you talk to Michael Clarke especially, Michael Clarke will say that, you know, the reason his batting got so good at such a young age was Neil DaCosta, especially his playing of spin. DaCosta had a huge impact on him. Even if DaCosta played, he would have played a handful of games of first-class cricket. And I suppose another one that you have to look at is Troy Cooley, who he might have made first-class cricket, but you know, he played in a very average Tasmanian team and he took wickets at about 60 runs a wicket. So I don't think the two are that together. I mean, if you're a good coach, you're a good coach. It really doesn't matter at what level it is. But I do understand what you mean when you say you know how to get there. But maybe, you know, that can be part of a structure. Perhaps you have a coach on one level, and then you have someone else who teaches you about the actual, you know, what you need to do to get up the levels of cricket.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and certainly when it comes to fielding, there's nowhere near the same association between fielding and being a former player, because a lot of the top fielding coaches come from just a completely different background, don't they? I mean, Australia have got a baseball guy, haven't they? Or they did have.
Yeah, he's now with India, actually.
Is he?
Mike Young. But yeah, and that's somewhere that I had a high school teacher years ago. He wasn't a sports teacher. He was actually a law teacher, and he'd do law and social studies and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And he actually always used to say that the problem with cricket was that they don't bring in enough other sports to see to help out with coaching, especially. And it's funny that Australia pioneered a lot of different slow balls, and that had a lot to do with Dave Neilson, the baseballer. And now you've got also Australia, you know, the Australian fielding techniques coming along so much more. When other than South Africa, most countries were sort of still in the dark age, and that came from a baseball coach again. So I mean, maybe there's no reason why you can't get things from other sports. And I think sometimes sports are a little bit negative and conservative, and they don't look out. And you know, in this particular case, Mike Young has done a lot for Australian cricket.
And yeah, and it's especially true, I think, that, you know, whatever is happening at the top, you can probably see at least double the conservative level when you see the amateur level as well.
Yeah, for sure. I know every time I was at a club where a new, you know, a radical new fielding technique was brought in, there would be, you know, half the blokes sitting there just saying, oh, we don't have to do this. You know, this is rubbish.
Yeah. I know Mike Boyle, who's an American strength and conditioning coach, says there's sort of three levels of bringing in a new idea, and it takes years to get through these three levels. The first is, this is a load of rubbish. What is this person thinking? The second is, maybe this guy's got a good idea, but I'm not going to use it yet. But maybe he's saying something. And the third is, oh, I've been doing that for years. I think that's quite a good way of seeing the development of an idea.
Yeah, for sure.
You talk about a lot of cricket at the top level. So sticking with coaching, how much influence do you think a modern coach has on that level?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I must admit, I do find myself more in the Shane Warne, Ian Chappell camp in a lot of ways. I think that if the captain isn't sort of the main man in cricket, it can take something back from the team. I mean, if you look at it on a basic level, there's really no other sport other than American football where one person on the ground has as much power and as much to do as a cricket captain. But the one difference is that the quarterback in American football has someone in their ear. So I think that the captain definitely has to be a major part. But having said that, Shane Warne doesn't practice what he preaches, because obviously Darren Berry was a very hands-on coach, even if he was an assistant coach for the Rajasthan Royals. So I don't think you can do what Ian Chappell says and have no coaches at all. I definitely think coaches are important. But unfortunately, in cricket, coaches end up being selectors, and you end up with your Duncan Fletcher type people that are sort of – I think it would be very hard for someone whose coach is a selector to go up to him and say, I'm struggling. And so I think maybe coaching should be a little bit less, how would you put it? Probably a little bit less dictator, as a dictator role. I think it should be more a support role and actually be there as the coach, and then have the captain as the main guy, and maybe the coach beneath him a little bit. And not that I don't think that coaches should be paid, you know, large sums of money. I think that if a coach is worthwhile, they should definitely be on, you know, big money, and it's definitely an important role in cricket. I just don't think that it needs to be the main role in professional cricket. Whereas at lower levels of cricket, I think maybe the coach should be the main person. But I think once you get to the top level of cricket, essentially the buck stops with the captain. He's the man on the field. He has to make all the decisions. You know, there was that big thing with KP talking about how Moore's ran out of ideas in that test against India when Tendulkar and Yuvraj Singh went on to chase down that large target. And I thought, well, if you can't come up with the ideas on the ground at the time, then you're just not good enough captain, and it really shouldn't come back to the coach.
So how do you judge whether a coach is doing a good job or not?
I think it can only really be done, in my head anyway, it can only really be done by the people who are in and around the team. I mean, it's not hard to see that Troy Cooley had a negative effect on Mitchell Johnson of recent times, trying to get him to bowl this in-swinger. Mitchell Johnson is obviously a player who, let's be honest, doesn't like to think too much. He likes to go back to the back of his mark, come in and bowl the ball quickly, and that's how he took 60-odd wickets in his first year of cricket. And then by the second year, everyone was trying to give him this in-swinger and trying to teach him all these bowling tricks. And I think that we saw during the Ashes that he doesn't handle that sort of action. So, I mean, in that particular case, you can see that a coach is struggling. Sometimes it's more obvious like that, and maybe other times it's something that only the captain and the selectors and the team management can see.
Well, speaking about coaching advice then, what's the best bit of coaching advice you were ever given?
Well, it's actually a really little one. It was with my batting. I used to bat on middle stump and when I first started playing turf cricket, because in Australia you start on synthetic. Mm-hmm. So when I first started playing turf cricket, I went out 9 times in my first season LBW. And we had a really good batting coach at our club who was a former Victorian State level guy. And he just said, why don't you bat on leg stump? And over the next 5 years, I went out LBW about 4 times. So it was just something simple, and it was something I'd never thought of. To be honest, I was an all-rounder, so I never thought too much about my batting. I'd go out there and give it a bit of a bash. But it obviously completely opened up my technique, and I'm probably better outside off stump, so it gave me a bit more room. But I would never have ever thought of moving to leg stump. It would never even come into my mind. So that was a pretty good piece of advice.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's one of those magical things that you always hope that someone just comes up to you and says, have you tried this, and it transforms you.
Exactly.
that doesn't happen very often, but it's brilliant when it does. A coach we work with was telling me about a session he did with a player who he managed to show them how to play the on drive, and that was that completely transformed everything, because once they could play the on drive, they, you know, suddenly all the other shots seemed so much easier.
Mm, yeah.
So, you know, even over the course of sort of an hour long session, he sort of transformed somebody's confidence and technique. What about the worst piece? Have you ever had a really bad piece of advice that you just thought, oh, that's completely wrong, I'm not going to do that, or you tried it and it just went horribly wrong?
My worst piece of advice is from a test cricketer, actually. when I was young, I was a fairly promising young leg spinner, but unfortunately everyone in Victoria at my age wanted to be a leg spinner in the whole Shane Warne aftermath.
Right.
And I don't have a very strong shoulder. I think I was a tennis coach as well, and I think over the years I sort of injured my shoulder a lot. And like most leg spinners, I actually need a lot of momentum coming through the crease. But unfortunately at that stage, there was only one way to bowl leg spin, especially in Victoria, and that was walking in off 5 paces and
right.
Ripping your arm over. But my dad wanted me to get some training in spinning, because there wasn't a lot of expert spinning training in club cricket at that stage. Mm-hmm. Because in the 80s, obviously, no one cared.
Right.
And then suddenly Shane Warne came along. And so I looked up, and there was only one guy who was a spin bowling coach in Victoria, and I rang it up. And quite quickly, I realized it was Ray Bright, the former Australian off spinner or left arm finger spinner. And he basically spent the whole conversation telling me that I didn't need to run in and I shouldn't be bowling front on. He basically, even in the conversation over the phone, he was just trying to turn me into a junior Shane Warne clone, even though I kept saying I've actually tried that because other coaches have tried to get me to do it. But I, for whatever reason, I don't spin the ball as much that way, and then I can't bowl my wrong in and I drop the ball short a lot more. But he was just having none of it. And in a 15-minute conversation, he just found about 30 different ways to tell me how to be more like Shane Warne. And I must admit, I never ended up getting any coaching off him. I didn't think it was that good. So I sort of coached myself from that point on.
Well, that's interesting. So with so many young Shane Warnes coming through at that time, what happened to them all? Why can't Australia find a spinner?
Well, that's the exact reason why they all went downhill. I'll tell you 2 stories, and they're both about coaching, so you'll like them. Victoria had another spinner who was only about 2 or 3 years younger than Shane Warne. His name was I've completely forgotten his name, but he was a really good bowler, and he took a few wickets, and he was much more in the Richie Beno style of bowling. were a bit more of a long flowing run up. Didn't spin the ball as much as Shane Warne, but had a much better variety in a lot of ways. And basically, over the years, he was trained to be more like Shane Warne, and it was all about refining him to make him more like Shane Warne until the day that he couldn't take wickets anymore, and he was dropped from Victoria. And then about 6 or 7 years later, he almost played for Victoria as an off spinner. So he was basically ruined. And then the other bowler was Cameron White, who came on basically like maybe like an Australian version of Kumble, I'd say, a bit more aggressive than Kumble, that sort of big, chesty, leg-spinning bowler. That doesn't spin the ball very much, but had a wrong-end that very few people could pick. Skidded on a lot, so got a lot of LBs. And he was basically picked apart and brought back as a to bowl more like Shane Warne so he could spin the ball more until, I think, if you look at the first part of Cameron White's career, he averaged about 30. Second part of his career, he averages about 70. And there's two people who had techniques that were working for them as leg spinners who were then tried to be remoulded as Shane Warne like and completely lost it. And I think most of the kids that I played with bowled like Shane Warne, but they weren't as good as Shane Warne. They dropped the ball short a lot more, didn't spin the ball as much, and eventually they got seen to. In fact, most of the best leg spinners I played against with and against bowled nothing like him.
Well, I don't think many people did bowl like him until he came on the scene. I mean, traditionally, the leg spinner is a bit more aggressive up to the crease, aren't they?
I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, if you look at all the old... I went to the cricket archive thing that the BFI hosts in London recently, and they had Arthur Malley, Chuck Fleetwood-Smith, Bill O'Reilly, and a few others, and they were all running in. You know, completely different sort of technique than walking in. And really, I can't think of too many other leg spinners who've ever walked in off the top of my head. Certainly not that have had long, sustainable careers.
And it was the accepted way to do it, to run in and attack the crease for a leg spinner until Shane Warne, and then suddenly you're not allowed to do it anymore.
Yeah, and when I played, I played in a representative side, and we in a squad of 14 players, we had 5 leg spinners.
Right.
Which sort of tells you how crazy it became. And of the 5 leg spinners, there were only 2 of us who had any momentum coming into the crease.
Let's talk a bit about the new book.
Lovely.
When Freddie Became Jesus. That's a great name. Can you pinpoint the exact moment that he did?
Well, I think he would have liked to have think he well that he did it at Lord's with that, you know, the pre-planned arms out pose and all the players coming in to him. And that's definitely, that's the one that obviously made me start thinking of the reference. But the book wasn't called that. The book had 100 different names. And as I was writing it, and then I got to the end and I was doing something about the fact that if you look at the Ashes, they were decided by Freddie, even though he didn't do much. At Cardiff, he was fairly ordinary. At Lords, he came back. At Edgbaston, he limped around and England couldn't do much. Headingley disappeared, and that was the only test Australia won. And then he comes back at the Oval. He's probably still not fully fit, but he does the one thing that he needs to do in the whole game, and that is get out Ricky Ponting with a run out. And so for me, he essentially at Edgbaston, he essentially died, and then he was reborn at Lords for that last. At the Oval for that last effort. So I suppose it sort of came generically from that. And then I'll be honest, I put it to my publisher thinking that there's no way they're going to allow this title of a book. And they loved it. So, it made the cover quite easily, obviously, except we weren't allowed to use the more famous image because it was he was using it on his book. But I actually like the one we used because it looks like Alistair Cook's coming in to actually put nails into his wrist.
I hadn't even noticed that. So it's all or mostly original material. It's not reworked from the blog or anything. This is from your own head.
Yeah, it's probably about 70% original. I have used a lot of stuff from the blog as well. Well, not just to be honest, I wrote for about 5 different publications during the Ashes. So I did some work for the Times, Wisden Cricketer, and Crikey. So there's a little bit from them. So most people haven't read everything that I did. So if I thought I wrote something good for them that wasn't on the blog, that's also in it. But yeah, it's mostly original stuff. I mean, some of the chapters are very blog-like anyway, but they just happen to be original and not from the blog. But basically, what I did was I took notes during the Ashes, and then I rewatched it all. you know, on illegal downloads and so forth, and also went through Crick Info and The Guardian ball by ball and compared it all to my notes and then sort of just came up with it from there.
Wow, that sounds quite a laborious process to go through all the different commentaries.
Yeah, it was, although I really enjoyed it. I must admit, over the years I've sort of grown fairly I'm not as much a fan as the old ball by ball and Crick Info as I used to be. But when you've got a really good writer, and I must admit that Will Luke especially, Brighton Coverdale was good, but Will Luke was amazing. Like I got to a point where I really enjoyed them. And obviously the Guardian one's exactly the same. I mean, you get someone really good like Rob Smythe doing a Guardian OBO, and I can understand why they have such huge followings because I really did enjoy it. Hearing the commentary of Sky was one thing that I probably didn't need to hear again. But no, I did enjoy it, although the biggest problem was I only had about 6 or 7 weeks to do the whole thing because I got married straight after the Ashes, and then I had had a week off sort of with that. So I had about 6 weeks to write the whole novel, which was probably a bit insane. But I prefer to do that than actually just rehash my blog. I know some of the other Ashes posts, some of the other Ashes books are essentially just reworkings of their work online and, you know, in print, which is fine. I've done that before, but I wanted to do something slightly different. So I did 7 weeks of intense writing. I've never been so busy in all my life.
What do you think the legacy of those Ashes are going to be?
I'm not sure if it is a legacy Ashes series, really. I think if people remember it, they're just going to remember two fairly hard-working average sides going up against each other. I'd say even by the time the next Ashes is here, people will still be talking about 2005, unless something amazing happens in the Australian Ashes. It was a series where English bowlers really massively underperformed, except in certain little areas, and the Australian bowlers sort of underperformed over a greater period of time, but did take the majority of the wickets. I think when no one really took over with the bat, I mean, Clark and Strauss were the only two, but even then they probably didn't take over the way that, you know, someone like Steve Waugh would have years ago. So there isn't anything that you can overly remember. Maybe Graham Swan cheering his 50 at the Oval like he just made 300 might stick out in some people's minds, but other than that, I don't know. It was a fairly average series.
So the perfect fodder for a book.
Yeah, well, I think it actually, I wrote about it in the end. For me, it's more interesting. I think if I wrote on 2005, it would be it'd be almost too easy. I think with me, sometimes the duller something is, the more fun I have creatively with it. You know, it gives me a chance to go off on weird rants. I think at one stage I compare the Ashes players to reality TV singing contestants and things like that. Whereas maybe if you were doing 2005, there's so much to talk about that it's hard to do, and it would be almost hard to write from my point of view. And I think I also like the fact that it's two low down and dirty sides sort of coming at each other, you know, both ranked fourth and fifth in the world. I don't know. There's something about that that the Ashes still rose above it, in as much as that it was on the front page of the papers and everyone wanted to talk about it. But it really was just, you know, two pretty ordinary sides coming together.
And finally, this is the Christmas special, so although it's pre-recorded, it's going to be going out on Christmas week. So when you're listening to this, it might be just before Christmas or maybe just a little bit after. So what will you be doing on Christmas Day?
Christmas Day, I'll be with my wife's family, and I think they usually sit around and watch whatever's on TV.
Yeah.
So hopefully someone gives me a book to have a read of. But yeah, no, it's a pretty good day. You know, the whole family gets together and it's a lot of good food and drink. And then I try and stay up till very late and watch Boxing Day a little bit. Last year, I don't remember a ball being bowled in the first session. I was still quite drunk at that stage.
So you'll be at least trying to watch the test.
Yeah, I always try and watch the first session while I'm over here. Unless it was maybe an Ashes day. Oh, well, hopefully when I see Ashes, I'll be over there. But if it was a big test, I might watch a little bit longer. But you know how it is. You've been up all day for Christmas. It's a long day. You've had a few drinks, and then you're trying to focus on Boxing Day. It's not always the easiest thing in the world to do, as much as it's obviously Boxing Day was, you know, one of the biggest things in my life until a couple of years back.
And definitely no backyard cricket this year.
No, it's something I really miss. I used to love the backyard cricket. I mean, it always ended up in fights and so forth, but we loved it. And, we used to play until we lost all the balls. So we'd start with about 7 or 8 tennis balls, and then the older we got, the further we'd hit them over the fence just to be smartasses. I used to love the backyard cricket, but it's not so easy over here in the temperature.
No, exactly. Well, I think that's the end of our chat. So have a very good Christmas.
Yeah, thank you very much. Same to you.
And just for everyone listening, don't forget that you can visit www.pitchfishing.com even on Christmas Day. The site's updated even on Christmas Day. And you can subscribe to this show for free in iTunes. Just look for My Cricket Coach or click on the subscribe in iTunes button on this week's show notes. If you have any questions for us, cricket coaching questions for us, we'll be back to the normal format next week, so you can email us on mycricketcoach@pitchfishing.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. So until then, this is David Hinchliffe.
This is Jared Kimber.